Hello and welcome to Behind the News, Year-End Retrospective Edition. My name is Doug Henwood. Today's format is so unusual I can't even make a joke about it. We'll be hearing excerpts from five interviews broadcast during 2024 and conclude with some words from the organizer Jane McAlevey, a friend and frequent Behind the News guest who died on July 7th. Israel's war, not only on Palestinians but increasingly many of its neighbors, was the big story this year, and three of the five interviews reflect that. Rashid Khalidi and Pankaj Mishra bring a historical perspective to today's horrors, and Anil Sheline adds a former insider's view. Then we'll hear from Aziz Rana on the awfulness of the U.S. Constitution, from Anna Kornblue with a cultural critique of immediacy, and then Brooke Harrington will talk about the offshore money-hiding racket. On to the interviews. Rashid Khalidi recently retired as a professor of history at Columbia. His book, The Hundred Years' War in Palestine, was published by Metropolitan Books in 2020. This interview was first broadcast in October. So applying the term settler colonial to Israel really annoys its supporters, but not only is it accurate, it's pretty much the language the early Zionists used. Could you review the history of that discourse?
The early Zionist leadership, people like Theodor Herzl, Chaim Weizmann, except Jabotinsky, Ben-Gurion himself, all believed they had a right to take over Palestine. They believed they had a biblical right. They believed they had a right as people persecuted in Europe and in need of a refuge. They represented a national movement or an attempt to develop a national movement out of Judaism and the Jewish people, a modern national movement. At the same time, none of them made any bones about the fact that they were doing this as part of a settler colonial process. The names of the institutions, like the Jewish Colonization Agency, one of the major institutions that was involved in taking over land from Palestinians, indicates that they understood that this was a process of colonization. The one who was the most open about it was Jabotinsky, who said that, you know, this is a colonial process. We have a right here, but we understand that this is like any other colonial process, and colonized peoples always will resist. Others were less forthright about it, but they all understood the same thing, that whatever their rights were, whatever the justice of their cause in their eyes was, they were doing something that involved displacing an entire people in a colonial process. Nobody ever contested that, really, before World War II. When suddenly decolonization began and colonialism had a bad odor globally. And so Israel, the Zionist movement, and then later Israel, began to describe itself as an anti-colonial actor because they had come into conflict with the British for a number of years during and immediately after World War II. But the colonial settler nature of this was confirmed after Israel's victory in 1947-48, 49, when they expelled 750,000 Palestinians, stole their land, refused to allow them to return, took over all of their property. This is settler colonialism. There's no other description for it, really. And anybody with eyes to see who has watched the process of the colonization of the West Bank and occupied Arab East Jerusalem and the occupied Golan Heights since 1967 cannot see anything but settler colonialism. I mean, I cannot imagine how you would describe it unless you're a biblical fanatic and say this is the return of the Jewish people to a land to which only they have rights. Well, if you believe that, we are not involved in the same discourse.
A striking thing reading the history is how the Zionist project has relied on imperial patrons, which counters all the David and Goliath metaphors, the settler,
right,
to sell their project. First it was Britain, now the U.S. Sometimes one wonders what was in it for the patrons. So let's talk a bit about the British. Why their fervor from Balfour onwards? The British ruling class has a long history of anti-Semitism. Did it just want to get the Jews out of Europe? What explains the fervor for the project?
Two things explain the fervor for the project. The first is ideological. It goes back to the early 19th century, before modern political Zionism had ever developed, before even the first modern political Zionist writings were committed to paper. And this has to do with a movement in the Anglican Church in England and among Protestants generally, a great renewal of faith and a rereading of the Bible such that the return of the Jews to the Holy Land was seen as a bounden Christian duty in order to hasten the second coming of Christ and so forth. We get this same view among many evangelicals in the United States today. This starts in the early 19th century, both in the United States and in Britain. The figure most closely associated with it is a very influential British aristocrat by the name of Lord Shaftesbury. He was the father-in-law of the British Prime Minister, Lord Palmerston. he and many others pushed this. And this became ingrained in the British Protestantism, this understanding that it was a bounden duty to return the Jews to the Holy Land. Now, it just happens that at the same time, you have, as you pointed out, a deep strain of anti-Semitism in England, which goes back to the 12th century when King Edward kicked all the Jews out of England. It was one of many cases where European rulers expelled the entire Jewish population. The King of France did it in the 13th century. The kings of Spain and Portugal did it in the end of the 15th century. And that virulent, theologically based anti-Semitism was there at the same time as you had this, I guess you'd call it philo-Semitism or Christian Zionism, among members of the British ruling class. The great irony is that Lord Balfour, who obviously is the person who pens the Balfour Declaration on behalf of the British cabinet in November 1917, in a previous incarnation as conservative prime minister, was responsible for one of the most anti-Semitic acts since King Edward, which was the Alien Exclusion Act to prevent Jewish refugees from the pogroms, the deadly pogroms that were going on in the Russian Empire at the turn of the 20th century, from coming to Britain. So you have both of those elements, which have to do with both philo-Semitism and Christian Zionism and anti-Semitism. And secondly, and I think much more important, you have a strategic element. Britain realized early on in the 20th century that it was absolutely vital to its strategic interests, control of the shortest route to India, which meant control of the Suez Canal in Egypt, which meant protecting the eastern frontier of Egypt, which they saw as vulnerable, and which in fact turned out during World War I to be vulnerable, by controlling Palestine. And the related realization that there was a possibility of the building of a railway between the Mediterranean and the Gulf, which would become the shortest land route through the Mediterranean and via railway to the Gulf. And the British decided they had to control that as well. That's why you have some very peculiar shapes on the map today.
Is there a way out of where we are? One secular democratic state sounds appealing, but impossible to imagine. The old two-state solution, with the Palestinian one fully sovereign and not an apartheid-style Bantustan. That seems almost as dreamy, more than ever after this latest round of bloodletting, and given the destruction of the civilizational infrastructure of the Palestinians and the hardening of Israeli attitudes. Can you imagine any kind of plausible solution at this point?
Well, I don't think anything is possible in the immediate future, given what you just said. I mean, Israel suffered a series of traumatic shocks on October 7th. It was the first invasion of Israeli territory since 1948. It was the largest civilian death toll in Israel since 1948. It was the first, I would argue, the most severe defeat of Israel's military, certainly since 1973. And 800 civilians were slaughtered, were killed. It was a massive intelligence failure. The traumatic shock of all of that is still reverberating in Israel and has very much hardened Israeli attitudes. The slaughter of 42,000 people in Gaza, as you can imagine, has hardened Palestinian attitudes. And the ongoing slaughter of whatever it is, whatever the toll is, 1,200 people, most of whom, as always with the Israelis, are civilians, is going to harden attitudes in Lebanon and other parts of the Middle East. So nothing can be envisaged in the short term. In the medium and long term, you're going to see decreasing support for Israel in the West. This ludicrous idea of shared values is going to be tattered. Now, Western values may change. The West may become more autocratic, more undemocratic, more hostile to the rest of the world. That's certainly possible. The rhetoric of a Trump or the rhetoric of an Orban or the rhetoric of the Austrian party that just won the elections indicates that that's a possibility, in which case Israel is a perfect ally. Tramples all over international humanitarian law, spits at the United Nations, is hostile and racist towards non-Jews. That's an attitude that I think a lot of major political parties, including the Republican Party, would find perfectly congenial. But unless that is the future of Western European countries and the United States, there's going to be a separation of ways between this absolutely essential metropole and this project in Israel. And there's going to be a problem within Israel. Because a lot of people are going to say, is this the country I want to bring my children up to live in? There's a flight of people from the Middle East. There's a flight of Israelis from Israel. There's a flight of Palestinians and Lebanese as well. 100,000 people, Lebanese, left for Syria in the last 24, 48 hours. Imagine going to Syria, a war-torn country, because you're in such danger in Lebanon. But, you know, Lebanon, Palestine, Jordan, Egypt, Syria, those countries are going to endure. Israel is going to have a problem because the kind of people who are leaving are the doctors from the hospitals, the high-tech folks, the investors, the professors, the more liberal element of Israeli society, and also the more educated and more productive members of Israeli society. And this is going to be a problem going forward. Do you really want your children to be occupying South Lebanon in 2030? Do you really want your children to be occupying Gaza in 2028? Well, that's the future that this regime, this government in Israel, is plotting for that country. I don't think that that's a very that's a future that a number of Israelis, at least, are going to enjoy living with.
That was the historian Rashid Khalidi from an interview first broadcast in October. And now some of an interview first broadcast in March with the essayist and novelist Pankaj Mishra. His essay, The Shoah After Gaza, was published in the London Review of Books. Early Israeli views of Holocaust survivors weren't very generous, were they? Could you remind us what they were like? Ben-Gurion had some nasty things to say.
No, because I think they were seen as shameful evidence that Jews had been robust enough in combating their enemies. Mind you, I was just reading a biography of Zygmunt Bauman, and these attitudes actually were also there in the late 60s when he moved to Israel from Poland. Again, he came up against this prejudice of, oh, people from a part of the world from Poland where Jews had meekly gone to their deaths. So that was a prevailing prejudice, certainly in the late 40s, and then, as I say, persisted for long afterwards.
What changed that? Menachem Begin had something to do with it.
I'm not sure. I mean, it's hard to say, obviously, whether attitudes broadly shifted or became more sympathetic. You have to remember that Holocaust survivors also started to die at some point. But what changed, certainly, was the national ideology of Israel became more closely affiliated with this narrative of victimhood. That was Begin's contribution to this. I mean, obviously people had brought this up in the past, but he was the one to actually give it institutional form, this ideology of the Holocaust as essentially justification for whatever the state of Israel does. That was his innovation.
At the same time, in the West, the Holocaust initially in the early post-war decades was not paid that much attention to, but then that started changing in the late 60s, right? What happened in the West?
Yeah, it's interesting to remember today that there was no such thing as the Holocaust. The category did not exist for a long time after 1945. The killings of the Jews, the mass murder of the Jewish population of Europe, was not seen as an atrocity separate from, you know, the many other atrocities of the war. And, you know, one has to also remember, I suppose, that there were tens of millions of people dead in 1945. The Soviet Union alone had about, you know, more than 20 million dead. So back then, you know, if you were amongst the countries, if you're living in one of the countries that had suffered from the war, you were not so prone to look at this particular category or think about it too much, the category of the Holocaust. It was a later construction, a later idea, and public awareness of it, of course, came even later. Public awareness in the United States, I mean, most people, most historians have said it really only came in the late 70s with the broadcasting of the television program, The Holocaust. And that is also true, apparently, for Germany, that Germans really had their sort of first public mass exposure to the ugly realities of what their ancestors had done when they first saw this American series. And likewise in, you know, many other countries, so, I mean, especially countries, I think, where there had been high degree of collaboration with Nazis, that awareness never really fully arrived. I mean, I'm thinking also of states that were then ruled by communist regimes who had their own reasons for not emphasizing the murder of Jews and, you know, who kind of insisted that the fight against Hitler was a fight against fascism. So they had their own particular narrative. It suppressed the Holocaust.
Begin worked with darker Israeli Jews and worked with their resentment of their maltreatment at the hands of the European Jewish elite. By reading that, I was reminded of some of the things that the planter class did in the U.S. South, working with the poor whites. Tell us a little bit about how Begin did some of that propaganda work.
I use the phrase there, the wages of Israeliness, which is, you know, a phrase inspired by the famous book called Wages of Whiteness. about precisely how American racism offered the poorest of the whites the chance to feel socially superior to the most wretched in that particular society, and that was the African-American population. We see this dynamic playing out in different parts of the world. As I speak, it's playing out in India, where the Prime Minister, Mr. Modi, has created a very broad platform for himself and his party by offering to low-caste Hindus a chance for social mobility. And how is that social mobility achieved? It's achieved by turning them against the weakest and the poorest members of the population, which happen to be Muslims. So we've seen this kind of ideological, rhetorical, and very successful maneuver in country after country. And obviously, in the 70s, Israel was also ripe for a demagogue like Begin to come in and exploit the racial tensions there and create this new narrative which could bind this very, you know, loosely imagined community into a much more cohesive Israeli community.
Going back to the evolution of Israeli attitudes, some of the early critics of the really bellicose turn of Zionism were themselves either survivors of or witnesses to the Holocaust. It recovers some of that forgotten history for us.
There were lots of people back then who had, if not actually spent time in the death camps, but, you know, at least were caught in those horrific events in Poland and Ukraine and the Soviet Union, who were instinctively anti-Zionist. Actually, obviously, I can't possibly mention all of these people in the lecture I wrote. But the person that comes to mind is Victor Klemperer. Now, Victor Klemperer is famous for the diaries he kept while living in Nazi Germany. And these diaries are actually, I mean, incredibly valuable testimony to someone describing daily existence in Nazi Germany during those, you know, terrible years in the 30s and 40s. Now, what's interesting about Klemperer, which again, a lot of people who invoke him as a great witness don't talk about, is how militantly anti-Zionist he is. And then he maintains this position. After the war, he goes to live in East Germany. And he's constantly talking in his diaries and his other writings about how Zionism, I mean, he goes really much further than a lot of these critics. I mean, Primo Levi and Jean Améry started to frame their criticism in the late 70s or early 80s. But the comparisons to Nazism are already being made by Victor Klemperer in the 40s and 50s. At some point, he's recounting an argument with someone who's just come back from Israel, a German Jewish person who had moved to Israel and then moved back to Germany because he was so disgusted by the way Israelis were treating Arabs. This is, mind you, in the 1950s. And Klemperer says that, the Israelis treating the Arabs badly are as bad as the Nazis. And then he corrects himself because obviously this is an exaggeration and says, well, it's still pretty bad. There are people already being very critical of Israel at a time. And these are survivors. These are witnesses at a time when there's really very little even information or awareness of what is going on between Israelis and Arabs in the 1950s. You know, all this comes to the attention of the world only in the late 1960s, with 1967, there's sort of broader awareness of what's going on in that particular region. So there are lots of histories of this kind, personal histories, social histories of an opposition to Zionism, and of course going back, you know, 1920s and 30s. I mean, what's amazing, truly amazing, is that Zionism should become the default position of so many people today, when in fact anti-Zionism was the default position of some of the most intelligent and talented people.
That was the essayist and novelist Pankaj Mishra. His essay, The Shoah After Gaza, can be found on the London Review of Books website, lrb.co.uk. And now on to the third of our highlights of 2024, this from a conversation with N.L. Schielein, I got to know her because she was a fellow at the Quincy Institute with an expertise on Saudi Arabia. She left Quincy to take a two-year job at the State Department, but she only lasted a year and resigned in disgust over the Biden administration's support for genocide. Here she is from an interview first broadcast in May. Biden, Blinken, Miller, and all the flacks talk about trying to restrain Israel. Yet at least until some bomb shipments were suspended the other day, nothing happened. There was no sign of any material pressure at all. No change in UN behavior. What did you make of that earlier stance, the verbal dedication to restraining Israel, but no actual material efforts to do so? And now this latest act, the suspension. It looked like PR then, and it's hard to trust them now. So how do you see the past behavior in this latest shift?
I definitely think that the administration has treated this whole issue as a PR issue rather than an issue of dire moral consequence as well as dire legal consequence.
Where does this policy come from? A lot of career people at the State Department, in one respect, you know, the CIA and the intelligence community generally, don't think it's fully wise. Why this intense support of Israel? Now, of course, this is a longstanding U.S. position, but it seems especially stubborn and grotesque now, given the scale of the carnage. Biden has barely uttered a word of sympathy for Palestinians, if one at all, and otherwise he sounds, if not quite like Ben-Gavir, like he could be a member of Likud. What is going on here?
I don't have a great answer for that. I've asked people this myself. People are baffled. The answer I usually give is just this is a generational issue. Biden is from a much earlier generation, and the state of Israel that exists in his mind is not the ugly and very aggressive, bloodthirsty state that, you know, the whole world is watching carry out this genocide. Someone said he's an 80 or 81-year-old man. It's really hard to get old men to change their minds about anything. And, you know, as a politician, he is someone who has received more money from the Israel lobby than I think anyone, which partly just reflects his many, many decades in politics. But again, it defies logic because he's still in politics because he's good at being a politician. And so the stubbornness with which he holds to this unconditional support for a state that is carrying out a genocide, it's just not good politics. And, you know, things like the campus movements, these are not just a handful of radical students. I mean, these are students across the entire country at some of our most elite institutions. These students come from powerful and wealthy families. The parents of these students are also going to be very, you know, are already extremely unhappy with the way that campuses have not protected their students from the violence of counter-protesters. The New York Times, you know, showed that in 99% of cases, the pro-Palestine protesters themselves were not violent, that the violence was coming from these counter-protesters. I don't know, other than just to say Biden is the one making these decisions, and he's an old man, and he's is just unwilling to change his mind.
Is it mostly Biden and the people around him? Is it really mostly a small circle of people making his decisions?
Yes. Oh, definitely. Some people have asked about Blinken, and my understanding is even Blinken isn't necessarily the one making these calls. Blinken has tended to express much more empathy and concern for Israeli victims of violence than he has for Palestinian victims. Obviously, someone in such a senior position needs to express the fact that it is unacceptable for any civilians to be targeted or killed, and that U.S. policy is that that applies equally to all people around the world. But I don't think Blinken is the one making these calls. I do think it's Biden, it's Brett McGurk, it's Jake Sullivan. Tom Sullivan, I believe, is Jake's brother. He's relatively senior inside state. And my understanding is that's sometimes how Blinken hears about some of these things, is it comes from his employee.
That was Anel Sheline, who is now back as a fellow at the Quincy Institute. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break.
Law and the law won.
That was some of I Fought the Law by the Bobby Fuller Four. They didn't write the song, but they put it on a map. It's also a cheesy setup for my next segment, a look at the U.S. Constitution, a deeply undemocratic document that is nonetheless revered. Aziz Rana, a professor of law and political science at Boston College, published a book in April called The Constitutional Bind, on the flaws in the document and the cult around it. As I was reading the book, I kept thinking of Bill Clinton's aphorism that what's wrong with America could be cured by what's right with America. It's just no way out of this perfect circle.
The framework that somebody like Clinton embodies is a romance about a Cold War national project that has a very particular way of thinking of the Constitution. That the Constitution is at the heart of that project, that the Constitution also goes hand in hand with this idea that the U.S. has been free and equal from the founding, that it's committed to anti-totalitarian civil liberties values, that those civil liberties are themselves tied to a commitment to property rights and to market capitalism, that all of that is also connected to a very restrained version of representative institutions with a powerful and insulated Supreme Court, and that together it's a justification for American exceptionalism and why the U.S. should enjoy global primacy. And that way of thinking of the country really solidifies and consolidates in the mid-20th century. It's what I call the official story of the creedal constitution. And it's what both political parties really found themselves committed to. What we're seeing really over the last half century is not just the consolidation, but the steady exhaustion of that framework for addressing the really profound problems, both internationally and domestically, that the U.S. finds itself confronted by. And the way in which this way of thinking about American life has not only led to a status quo in which our institutions are pretty profoundly undemocratic, but it's also facilitated an approach to the world that ends up promoting forms of discretionary violence overseas and then undercuts our capacity to really think in genuinely democratic terms. We're at a moment where we can finally think outside those truisms of creed and constitution that have so shaped the basic presumptions of how politicians have spoken to us for decades.
You've got to give the Founding Fathers credit for devising a system that looks democratic, but is actually an excellent foundation for plutocratic rule. It's quite a remarkable document.
It's important to understand like the context in which the federal constitution was drafted. On the ground in what would become the states, there was a kind of rippling of Euro-American settler little d democracy. So you had emerging arrangements that provided a great deal of direct political participation through strong legislatures, legislative supremacy, to local farmers, artisanal workers, white laborers. Now, this, of course, went hand in hand with really extractive forms of territorial conquest, the expropriation of indigenous land, the construction of labor regimes that were built around the coerced labor of non-settlers, particularly enslaved black people. But for the insiders, there was a very rich flowering of democratic politics. But this was a kind of politics that by the latter part of the 1780s, you had a range of commercial and gentry elites that viewed as a threat to the long-term sustainability, not just of their rule, of like a powerful new nation. And so you have the construction of a constitutional system that on the one hand does actually commit itself to versions of representative government, but on the other hand sees the primary threat to rights, and here we're really talking about property rights, as coming from mass majorities and strong legislatures. And so sees the primary threats as demagogues, but demagogues tied to popular majorities. And what socialists at the end of the 19th, early 20th century said is that what this ignored was the other really clear threat to rights, and here the rights of most of the people that were landless or didn't have property, and that's from socioeconomic elites that embodied what Charles Edward Russell called an invisible government that could use their cultural and material resources to take advantage of all of the fractured elements of the American constitutional system to pose their will and to undermine really the one thing that poor and working class Americans had, which was the power of the vote. And so you have a system that has elements, no doubt, of representative government, but that is framed around a presentation of threat that sees democracy as the primary threat. And then I would just add, for black radicals and black socialists, there was an additional argument, which is that this system also really set up a framework that made the most evident form of authoritarianism in the U.S. a brand of white authoritarianism, in which it was very easy for landed racial elites to assert control both over the economy and over the political process in ways that undermined the flourishing of something like a genuinely multiracial democracy.
There's been a line of discourse throughout American history that the problem with our political structures is that some people have not yet been included in this wonderful structure. That women, black people, immigrants, indigenous populations have yet to be incorporated fully into the wonders of the American political structure. But once that happens, we'll reach perfection. Now, there's also another way of looking at it, which is those exclusions are really foundational to the whole system. What about that? Are those exclusions really foundational, or is it just a matter of incompleteness?
The classic way of thinking about American national identity that's a product of this creedal constitutional narrative is that the U.S. is just incompletely liberal. And so that if you include outsiders, then you'll be able to complete the national project. And that means that the primary problems in the present are laws that formally discriminate against groups and the fact that you don't ensure that, let's say, elites within historically marginalized communities have an equal opportunity to access positions of professional and political power. These are real problems. But I don't think that they get to the depth of the structural limitations or weaknesses that have marked American life. And this has to do with the ways in which this book on the Constitution connects to my first book called The Two Faces of American Freedom. We can understand large chunks of American history as organized around a politics of settlerism that combines really rich internal accounts of freedom and economic opportunity to external projects of territorial conquest and coerced labor. That infrastructure, even as the society's governing ideology moved toward creedal constitutionalism, even as explicitly segregationist laws were removed from the books, that infrastructure that affected the basic organization of American state and economy were not systematically addressed. It's why when during the Obama years, you could both have folks saying that the country was now quote-unquote post-racial, but then if you just looked at issues of endemic poverty and questions around the carceral state, you could also say that the country was living through a second or new Jim Crow marked by hyper-incarceration and profound structural inequality. So what does that mean for the present? Absolutely, we need to eliminate some of the explicit exclusionary elements that continue to persist. And so I support, for instance, things like moving toward resident voting so that non-citizens can also vote.
Which was true in the early days of the country, right?
Absolutely. So that it was commonplace for European migrants, non-citizens, to have the capacity to vote really up through toward the end of the 19th century.
When the wrong kind of Europeans started arriving, right?
Exactly. So that shifted in the context of changing demographics around who is engaged in migration. And then certainly I think that we need to get rid of things like disenfranchisement on the basis of carceral status, folks that are previously imprisoned. But that's only one piece of the story. Alongside getting rid of explicit exclusions, it's also essential to think really systematically about the comprehensive infrastructure of our legal political processes. And that means understanding that a commitment to genuine democracy isn't just allowing more people a formal vote within a system that fractures the effective power of an idea committed to one person, one vote, but instead infusing the experience of democratic self-rule across all of the sites that shape American life. And that these were ideas that long-standing reformers within black freedom politics, feminist politics, socialist politics, indigenous politics, and immigrant politics had across large swaths of American history. And yet one of the effects of the narrowing of the idea of what counts as a constitutional question to whatever it is that judges and elite lawyers discuss with respect to Supreme Court doctrine, is that that entire constitutional memory and all of those constitutional actors have effectively been removed from the field of discussion.
That was Aziz Rana, whose book The Constitutional Bind was published in April by the University of Chicago Press. And now a departure from the norm, a cultural turn, with Anna Kornbluh, whose book Immediacy or the Style of Too Late Capitalism was published in January by Verso. It's a critique of a society that has lost the ability to step outside itself. and his day job is as professor of English at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Immediacy is a word with multiple meanings. Immediacy meaning in the sense of right now, but also without mediating structures. So, yeah, tell us what precisely constitutes immediacy.
I do like all of those things. I think the limitless thirst for right now, right here, immersion, intensity, realness is part of it. And the rejection of mediating structures or intervening structures, the intolerance for representation or for the thicknesses of language and finding forms and finding ideas that work as bridges that sort of take us out of the immersive experiential quality of the right here, right now, that give us distance in time or in perspective on things. All of that negation of mediation and surging of the fullness of presence or intensity, imminence, that's what I mean by immediacy. But the kind of colloquial things about speed and then the ways that in our everyday cultural and economic activities, we rely now on fluidity, direct message, instant access, on demand, all of those kind of features as real economic infrastructures for these sensations of immediacy.
What is the relation to this sense of speed up with just-in-time practices in industry, for example?
There's been some really interesting work trying to think about our speedy culture, both by sociologists and art historians and philosophers. Just-in-time logistics is, again, the kind of basis for understanding postmodernism originally, that this kind of integration of time and space is a result of really efficient practices of exchange. But those practices are revolutionized by information industry, digital technologies. They are intensified and streamlined in the 21st century in sort of different ways than they were operating in original Toyotaization in the 70s and 80s. Just-in-time has become the maxim of how we consume and what little we produce and what we expect of just experience now. Just-in-time is definitely the base for the kind of intensities that I'm trying to describe.
And a spreading sense of impermanence, too.
Yeah, right. Flexibility and evanescence and the dissipation and disposability or sudden loss or sudden breaks are features of the intensified exchange circuit.
Autofiction and autotheory are you write a lot about. You quote Maggie Nelson, one of the leading autofiction writers, as saying, "I have never been able to answer to Comrade," which I thought was a very interesting statement. What does that tell us about the politics of this new kind of literature?
Yeah, so autofiction is a kind of literature that's been around for a long time and has some variability in how it is practiced and in its economic and ideological situations. You know, France is different from the United States and so on, but has been a particularly enthusiastically embraced trend in 21st century Anglo fiction. It refers to fictions that are of the self or that are unmade or that are manifestive and emanative and fluid. And in the group of autofictionists that tend to be celebrated and tend to have like really big prizes and be really good sales figures and stuff that I'm kind of tracking, they often have really expressed rejections of fictionality. They really say things like, fiction is gross, it's, you know, it makes me nauseous to make up characters or to imagine a plot. I can only write about myself. The only thing that's real is a voice.
That quote from Tao Lind, which is a name that takes me back to like 2014, was a big deal in New York. He doesn't want to make up things to entertain people. He wants the writing to be helpful to him. A vision of writing as therapy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I think that this sense of the envelope of the self and that that's the only authentic stuff and that's the only legitimate representation really does, to go back to the question about Comrade, cohere with a kind of political vision of atomization and of the just illegitimacy of institutions or of forms that would sustain and scaffold comradeship or solidarity. It's not that there's a total correlation between these aesthetic ideologies and however people do political practice. But I do think that there is a lot of rhyme between a certain kind of political suspicion for collective action or collective organization and for the forms that would mediate collective organization, help us hold together our mass affect of the protest and vehiculate it into collective power, collective sovereignty, that's work of intervening forms, and that the suspicion of that stuff as, oh, that's just going to oppress us, that's just going to exclude people, that's just going to dominate us, where it's just corrupt, those are the master's tools, and so on, that political suspicion is part of this rejection of mediation, that its aesthetic faces the nobody should write fiction.
That was Anna Kornbluh. Her book Immediacy was published a year ago by Verso. And now a look at the money-hiding racket. Brooke Harrington, a professor of sociology at Dartmouth, has been studying offshore money for almost two decades. She's just out with Offshore, Stealth Wealth and the New Colonialism, published by Norton. Before I get into the interesting policy stuff, engage in a little of what we in the trade call service journalism. Say I have a few score million I got from shady activities or I want to hide it from the tax man. How would I go about this? Before you answer that question, what is the price of admission exactly? How much do I need to be a credible money hider?
I don't think many wealth managers would really take on a client who had less than about $5 million U.S. dollars in investable assets. And even that would be a borderline case. And for most Americans, your net worth is very heavily influenced by whether you own a home and the value of that home. But when wealth managers talk about investable assets, they're talking about your net worth minus the value of your home, because that's not a liquid asset that you could be moving around offshore. Most people don't meet that $5 million rock bottom threshold of investable assets. And even if you could sort of get over the hump with that amount, you'd be sharing your wealth manager with maybe a dozen or two other clients. If you really want the bespoke high-touch service, you're probably looking more at like triple that amount and upwards. When you start getting into $50 million or more, then you can have not just a whole wealth manager to yourself, but you might be able to have what's called a family office, where you have an entire team of advisors working for you. A wealth manager, maybe a philanthropy advisor, maybe a specialized accountant and tax advisor, et cetera, et cetera. Rockefellers and Bloombergs have that sort of family office arrangement.
Okay, and so if I have this money I want to hide, how do I go about it?
First, you get yourself a wealth manager, because if you're genuinely a wealthy person, if you're new money, you're probably pretty busy continuing to earn the wealth. And if you're old money, you're probably off on your yacht or in St. Bart's somewhere. And the last thing you want to do is bone up on the tax code of the Cayman Islands. So you need to hire a specialist who will keep abreast of the latest legal developments in a variety of important offshore centers. And then you outsource your wealth to them. If you have considerable wealth, you find service personnel through word of mouth, the way that you might find a nanny for your children or a hairdresser. Because the number one thing you're going to be concerned about is discretion and secrecy. And when you're really rich, that discretion is essential. A serious hazard of wealth is that wealth attracts all kinds of con artists and third cousins once removed who come out of the woodwork and they want a piece of what you've got. Likely, you're going to either find other rich people or get yourself introduced to other rich people, and then you have some discreet conversations with them about who's good, who can be relied upon as a wealth manager. And then probably you go interview a couple of them and you have strategy meetings. Like, here's what I want to accomplish. They'll ask you, what do you want to accomplish? Do you have children? Do you want to disinherit? Do you have a secret family? Famously in the offshore world, they say the median client is a man in his 50s who is married with children, but also has at least one mistress on the side who may also have children. And so part of the wealth manager's job is providing for these secret families and making sure that the wife doesn't know about the mistress and the mistresses don't know about each other, and keeping everyone happy and keeping them from suing to get their chunk of the client's wealth. Because once lawsuits start happening, then records become public and the game is up.
Gosh, life is so complicated when you're rich.
More money, more problems, as they say.
Now, what about Trump? You mentioned him. I'm divided between thinking he'll cut taxes for the rich so much that it won't be so important to hide your money, and thinking he'll just let the whole sheltering operation rip. What do you think is going to happen?
To kind of zoom back from that question a little bit, I think the ultra-rich in this country have largely solved the problem of not paying taxes. Oligarchs of old really had this two-pronged agenda, reducing taxation on themselves and reducing regulation on themselves. Here we are in the 21st century after a bunch of Republican administrations, and I think that dragon has been slain. ProPublica did some investigative reporting on the tax rates of people like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and found that the pair of them go entire years paying zero in income tax. And when they do pay tax, it ends up being in the neighborhood of 1 to 3.5% instead of the top marginal rate, which is by statute about, I think, 39.6%. They've effectively brought their tax rates down to zero already. So what's next for them? Right now, their big push seems to be to either supplant the U.S. dollar with crypto or to make crypto a peer of the U.S. dollar. J.D. Vance was installed basically by people who've gone all in on crypto. And as of yesterday, the incoming administration is thinking of appointing a specialized crypto czar and appointing Lutnick, a big crypto proponent, as secretary, I think it's Secretary of Commerce or Treasury.
Yeah, it's Commerce.
Starting in around July, when Trump, who used to be very anti-crypto and called it a scam, starting in July, Trump began giving keynote speeches at crypto conferences and saying, I am the crypto president. That is the next big play for American oligarchs. That worries me a lot because it's extremely destabilizing, not just for the U.S. economy, but for the world economy, which uses the U.S. dollar as its reserve currency and has done since the Bretton Woods Agreement of 80 years ago. What happens if you take that pillar of the world economy away? You definitely weaken American economic and political power worldwide. But like all of us who have our life savings denominated in U.S. dollars, what do we do when crypto becomes a competitor or a replacement for the dollar? Because it's a zero-sum game between the two of them. You can't have a strong dollar and strong Bitcoin or whatever the version of crypto is going to be. It's going to be one or the other. And right now, the Trump administration is pressing for crypto. If it goes that direction, it may moot a lot of these issues about using the offshore system, because then crypto provides secrecy that a lot of wealthy people and drug dealers and arms dealers like.
That was Brooke Harrington, professor of sociology at Dartmouth and author of Offshore from Norton. No look back at 2024 would be complete without remembering the great union organizer Jane McAlevey, who is also a good friend and frequent guest in the show. Jane fought cancer like she fought the boss. She often beat the boss, but cancer won in July. I miss her dearly as a friend, and everyone who wants to improve the state of the working class has to miss her as a fighter. Here she is with some observations on power.
A lot of people have been scratching their heads wondering why there's been so little resistance to the tax bill, in contrast with the fight against the Obamacare repeal. And we saw all this mobilization to preserve Obamacare, but this horrendous tax bill has received nothing of that level of opposition. What's going on here?
Well, I think a couple of things. One is, I think there has been a lot of sort of grassroots protest around the tax bill. But when we're thinking about the resistance, or the theory of the resistance, as it were, I think what some people get confused about, which is generally what happens when people don't have a good analysis or understanding of how power and power structures work, is that people saw a lot of activity in the campaign to defend Obamacare from the right-wing attack, from the new Trump administration attack. But you saw a lot of grassroots protests around the tax bill, too. But there's a really key, the key factor, in fact, that cuts a really big difference between what the fights to stop the tax bill look like versus what the fights to stop the repeal of Obamacare look like. And the key deciding factor was the role of corporations. So when progressives misunderstand power because they look and think, well, hey, we stopped, you know, it took three votes, you know, it was a valiant effort. I don't want to diss the idea that people didn't do good work around defending Obamacare in multiple rounds, right? There were multiple rounds to that fight. And three times in a row, three different efforts at repealing, quote unquote, Obamacare, progressives believed incorrectly that they were capable of stopping the attack on Obamacare. What people didn't understand is that the actual power in the fight to sort of stop the attack on Obamacare was that healthcare corporations were on the side of progressives. The American Hospital Association, the lobbying law firms that actually support the nursing home industry, the skilled nursing facilities, home care, and a lot of state governors, et cetera, were on the side of defending Obamacare because it's bringing huge, by the way, taxpayer subsidies into private corporations. So fighting to defeat the attack on Obamacare, we, quote unquote, progressives, radicals, whatever, had a divided corporate class. So we had corporations, nursing homes, and a bunch of insurance companies. We had a bunch of really key sections of capitalists, of corporations, on our side. Because why? It's about putting taxpayer money into private corporations at the end of the day, right? That's what the Health Care Act did. It just made it better so that more people had access to health care. When you look at the tax bill, that same alignment of progressives teaming up with a big, important section of the capitalist class of corporations, which is the health care lobby in this country, that fissured. Because at the end of the day, corporations and the super rich, which is who the healthcare corporations, insurance companies, nursing home lobbyists, et cetera, are, they realign with their proper alliance, which is the rich and the other corporations in the tax bill fight. So the level of power needed to defeat the tax bill was not well understood. It was never just that. Like, this is what happens. We defeat the Obamacare stuff. And the resistance, as it were, put out a message that, like, we have actual power, that tweeting and social media and a bunch of little protests is what actually defeated the attack on Obamacare. When what actually defeated it was the alliance, crucially, with a huge sector of actually very powerful corporate class players, which is the hospital association, the nursing home industry, and the insurance industry.
That was Jane McAlevey, who died on July 7th, 2024. That interview was first broadcast in 2017. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Please forgive me, but this is not only a New Year's cliché, we're already 2 days into 2025, but it's still glorious stuff. The conclusion of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, the Ode to Joy, performed by the Berlin Philharmonic under Herbert von Karajan. Till next week, bye.